I'm with Paul Jarvis, who is a bit of a modern day Renaissance man. He's a writer, designer, a podcaster, online course teacher, and software creator on the internet. And the reason we're talking today is through a mutual friend, Kaylee Moore. And I saw that he had this book called Company of One. And it really, really intrigued me for a lot of personal reasons. And so I'm really happy to have Paul here today. So thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks, man.
And you are in, where are you, New York or something?
You mean the opposite? I live in the woods on an island off the west coast of Canada.
Oh, you still live there. Okay.
Yeah, I don't live in Tofino anymore. The book starts, if people haven't read it, the book starts with me moving to Tofino with my wife. We live slightly south of there now, but we still actually do live in the woods on an island in the middle of nowhere.
I have a question I want to ask specifically about sort of what you were escaping, but I have something just itching to ask you before that, which is, have you always been this way? I mean, is this kind of who Paul is? Like, as you were growing up, were you somebody who would you just kind of knew what was right for you, even though it wasn't right or didn't feel right, you know, to anybody else? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it totally does. And no, I feel like I'm 40 now. I feel like the first half of my life was pleasing other people and working towards goals that they with good intentions, of course, set for me. Like, I think even growing up, I think most people are like that. I did obviously have a streak of like anti-authority. Like, I've never been able to shake that for better or for worse. But for the most part, it was just like, okay, well, this is how your life is kind of mapped out based on like, oh, you do well in school, you go to university, or you do well in university, or you get a corporate job. And like, I was living that for the first, I guess until I was about 18 or 19. And then I was like, nah, hard pass on that. I guess I woke up or something and I was just like,
What happened? I mean, was there like a incident or an event or something that occurred that got you to be like, I'm done?
Yeah, I mean, well, there wasn't necessarily like one catalyst event, but I just found myself I was in university for computer science and artificial intelligence, which seems like it would probably be pretty important nowadays. At the time, it wasn't. I was just bored, man. Like, I was in school and I was learning programming, but I was so bored of learning programming. I was doing more programming outside of school, and I was more interested in the programming and the design work that I was doing outside of school. I was like, why am I even doing this? And then I got offered a job that was paying as pretty much the salary I thought I would make when I finished the 4-year program. And I was like, this seems like this could be a good out.
So you ended up, how long ago did you leave? As far as, you know, I read the book that you did this, but I wasn't, yeah. I'm not totally sure like when you did this.
Yeah. So like I grew up in the suburbs outside of Toronto. So I lived in Toronto. I've lived downtown Vancouver. I lived downtown to Vancouver for a long time. And then I moved to the island in 2010 because it was during the Winter Olympics, which is the worst time. Like, there's no really good time to move, but moving out of a city when you live in the middle of where Olympic events are happening is the worst time. As far as when I decided to stop going to school and to work for somebody else, that I guess I was probably like 19, maybe.
Yeah, congratulations to you. I think some of us, including myself, sometimes think about that, like, what would it be like to just get away?
And for me, I feel like, I don't know why I didn't do that sooner, but I mean, it's different for everybody, right? Where it's like,
right.
And even like when I quit the program, I was talking to the dean and I remember being in his office and he was like, you're making a mistake. Like, two things are going to happen. You're going to regret that you left university, a good university and a good program. And you're going to come back and you're going to be older and you're going to have to start back from where you're just leaving now. And I was like, all right, dude, like, time will tell, I guess. Like, let's see what happens.
Yeah.
I don't think I called him dude, though. I'm pretty sure I didn't call him dude.
He called him Mr. Dude.
Yeah, Mr. Dude.
Called him. Mm-hmm. So we have this book, Company of One, and I'll tell you the reason why it caught my attention, the reason why it intrigued me was because I had a company for about 12 years. It was just an absolute roller coaster. The highs were really high and the lows were really low. And now that that's done with, that was sold in early 2017. I have zero desire to start a new thing that would involve employees and would involve somebody else's or everybody else's idea of what it means to have a company and grow and you know, the message that is sent to us pretty much throughout all society. Yeah. In regards to what it means to be an entrepreneur and, yeah, and what it means to start and grow a company. So I was really drawn towards that. That's cool. Kind of where that was coming from.
Well, yeah, thank you. It's so prevalent, like what you said. It's like we're kind of sold this bill of goods that entrepreneurialism looks this one way, and you have to do certain things for it to be considered a success by other people, and who are those other people, and why do their opinions even matter? It's just, I don't know. And I mean, that's really why I'm glad it resonated, because that's really why I wrote the book. So I was like, business doesn't have to look this one way, or like people who are entrepreneurs don't have to be a certain type of person or act a certain way or want even the same things or have the same idea of success. Like it can be totally different for everybody. And that's a good, like, that's actually a really, really good thing.
Well, it's very contrary to how people think. And there was something you wrote kind of early on. In fact, it may have even been like, I think in the introduction, where the statement you made was essentially almost paradoxical, where you were talking about, if you embrace growth, you're actually taking the easy route, you know, where I think that most entrepreneurs think of growth as, this is gonna be the hardest thing, but I got to do it and have to do, you know, go this direction. Tell me more about the thinking of that.
Yeah, it's easier to solve with more. And I mean, to take that out of just like a heady statement, if like if you have too many support requests to handle, it's easier just to hire somebody. If you don't have enough profit, it's easy just to think about the top number and say like, oh, we're just going to grow our revenue. And I think that while that can be difficult in terms of like implementation, it is the easiest solution for the most part to just add more to solve any problem your business might have. The problem is that more doesn't solve the problem. It's like not wanting to fall off your bike so you put a band-aid on. Like it just, it doesn't make sense because it's not getting at the root of the issue. I think it's more interesting and sometimes better to solve without adding more to the solution. And I mean, it requires creativity and ingenuity and resilience, sure, and it can definitely be difficult, but ultimately like if that's the way that you want to run your business, I think that makes sense. Like I never wanted to promote myself out of the job I like. I like doing the work. So I would never want to be the manager of other people doing the work. I feel like I'd be jealous. I feel like I'd be jealous of them. They'd be doing the work that I wanted to do. I'd be responsible for managing them. And it just would be a lose-lose situation in that point.
One of the things I thought was really interesting that I read in there was you had talked about how a lot of times when we're in a career or we have this business, we think that the only way to make a good salary and be in a good place, I would say financially, is to grow that business route type of thing. But you actually gave some pretty good examples where you could actually stay small and just refine what you're doing and not have all of these, we'll say resources, assets, people to pay
stresses and responsibilities.
Yeah, stresses and responsibilities, and still make a pretty good salary because you don't have that overhead, because you don't have, you didn't go that traditional route.
Yeah. I mean, my favorite story from the book, and my favorite story from like spending a long time interviewing people, is a friend of mine, Miranda Hickson, who is an interior designer, and her dad worked for himself as like a one person business, I guess, in the 70s, which is like when I was born. And I still remember the story she told, and I put the story in the book too, not to give it away for people, but he had a sticker on his computer, and it wasn't even one of these. It was like, oh no, this was probably like in the 80s, because there weren't even really like home computers. So she's younger. She's younger than me. But he had a sticker. He had a post-it note on his computer that said overhead equals death. And I'm just like, this is the book. Like, this is my this sticky note explains my life and how I feel about business so hard. Because it's just like we a lot of times we think about like increasing that top number, like increasing the gross revenue. And I mean, for me, I like to think about, how can I decrease the bottom? How can I decrease like the number of expenses that I have? Or like, where can I cut out extravagance in my life that doesn't serve me? And I mean, for that, then you technically can become profitable with less, and you can become profitable faster. Like, you can say you make $1 million a month, but it costs $900,000 to make that $1 million. So really you're only bringing in 100K, or you could make, say, $300,000, and it costs you 20 to make that. And you're technically left with more money, but you haven't had to, like you said, hire more people, spend more money, do more things, increase more stress, have more responsibility. And I mean, I think, like, dude, I feel like every business is a lifestyle business. And this is like a lot of people.
You want it to be a lifestyle business. I mean, in the way that I think you've approached this almost philosophically. I mean, it's treat it like a lifestyle business. You even talk about how, and this might come to a surprise to the people who are listening, but company one doesn't mean company of one. No. Company of one actually is a mindset. It is a way of approaching your job. And you talk about, I think kind of early on, that company one can actually be you in a big company.
Yeah.
And you kind of, you know, deciding what that actually means for you and how you're going to approach that job. Can you maybe talk more about that?
Yeah, I mean, just like Tim Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Workweek, isn't meant to be like you literally work 4 hours a week, and if you work more than that, you're a sucker. It's like, no, that's not the point at all. And so I think the whole idea of company of one isn't that growth is bad and that everybody should stay a one-person business. It's that we need to question growth and make decisions that are smarter for, one, like we were talking about, the lifestyle we want to lead, and two, that what we would consider a success for our business. And I mean, throughout the book, like I talked to people at like Buffer and Basecamp, for example, and they're, I don't know, 50 to 70 odd people. And I think they're perfect examples of companies of one, because they don't grow unless it makes sense, unless one is based on actual profit, not hopeful profit that they'll make in the future. And two, it's based on they've gone through the, like, can we solve for this without adding more? Does this work? No. Does this work? No. Does this work? No. Okay, maybe we do. Maybe it's too painful not to hire one more person or to add one more thing for things to work. And I mean, like you said, even for somebody in a big company, like, nobody's going to care. Nobody cares about your job, even if you work at a corporation, as much as you do. Like, you're the one who wants to be gainfully employed for as long as possible and hopefully get some raises and stuff. So you need to kind of approach things from the idea that, like, what can you do to, like, the traits of companies of one are like resilience. So you need to figure out like how you can be the most resilient. Like, if you want to keep your job, what can you do to keep it? You need to try to figure out how you can develop autonomy, because autonomy isn't anarchy. It's just the ability to make decisions based on kind of the way things have been laid out. Or being able to work quickly, or being able to work simply, or being able to have boundaries. And I think the lessons, while it definitely comes from like an entrepreneurial slant, because that's my life, it's still like, I was still very aware, like, how can this be, and really from the pushing of my editor and my literary agent. Mm-hmm. Like, how can this be kind of more universal to hit people who are in the corporate world, who maybe do want to go out on their own, but maybe they don't, and they just want to create like a more resilient job for themselves or a more enjoyable job for themselves in a company. And that's kind of the way that I approached it.
I think a lot of it depends too on just the company. I mean, in other words, the reality is that there are plenty of companies that won't receive this well, meaning, they won't appreciate the autonomous like approach to a job. Now, I would, as a manager, in fact, I've always been this way, which is essentially, you own this, go take care of it. And I don't want to micromanage it. You know, if I'm micromanaging it, it's because you're not owning it.
Yeah. And it's hard, to instill a sense of ownership if somebody can't make any decisions about it.
Right.
Like, that's really what it comes down to.
So I like it. It just makes me think, I'm thinking about maybe even what your editor was thinking about, just sort of, you know, what is somebody, how do they approach this with their manager, with their boss, if they're not even sure if it's going to fly in the environment they're in? I mean, what would you recommend for somebody if they're in a big company or even a small company, and they want to practice some of the things that they're going to end up reading in your book?
Yeah. I mean, small iterations. Like, I don't think it would work to go into any boss, no matter how open-minded they are, and say like, hey, look, I want to change every aspect of my job tomorrow.
And you're fired.
Yeah. Like, I don't think that would work. But I think that if you approach it in sort of like an iterative fashion, where it's like, I can get more work done if I'm not necessarily like butt in a chair from 9 to 5. If I can, like, if I don't miss any deadlines, can I have the ability to say work flexible, remote 1 day a week or half a day a week to start? And then when they see that you don't just like, they see that you're not like posting pictures to Instagram of you on like roller coaster rides or at the golf course all day, and you're getting the work done, then maybe they'll be like, okay, this makes sense. Or maybe you can be more focused if you're outside an office or even an open office environment, where you say like, look, I need to do some like deep and focused work here. The office environment is great for collaboration, but it's not conducive to like focused work. Can I do this at home and I'll still deliver on deadline, but I just need the space and the less distractions in order to do it. And then I think if you just approach it as like one-offs, like start with a little thing, start with maybe it's like half a day, maybe it's a day. And then as they see that you have more ownership and you're getting more things done and you're more productive, and it's not necessarily like you with your butt in a chair from 9 to 5 every day, then things could start to change. Things hopefully for the better, I would hope.
There's another sort of reality thing that comes to mind, and it has to do with, so I'm in my 40s, and so I existed before the internet. and I was entrepreneur early on in the internet. That's why I'm doing what I do now. And there was a period of time for, I think probably, I don't know, from the 2000s to 2010 or whatever in particular, where everybody was a CEO. like everybody and their brother was starting a company, and they were CEO of it. And it was like, everybody was
business cards. Pour
water on it, CEO.
Yeah.
It's just kind of, and so the reason why I'm bringing that up is because I'm thinking about maybe some people who are early into their career, meaning, you know, they're younger, and they either haven't or have maybe once kind of thought about being an entrepreneur or doing their own thing. And you covered this a little bit, which I really appreciated, which was that it's not simply about being autonomous. It's not about a certain mindset or practicing these things. It's also about being a master at your core skill set. Yeah. And that and that you can't just become something that you wish you were because you're passionate about it, but that it's a combination of skill and purpose. And I'd love to hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of times. And I mean, even like I've worked for myself for 20 years as well. So like I definitely saw that in the early, I guess they're called the aughts, which I hate saying, like it just sounds silly. But in like the early 2000s, when everybody was that. And I think it's still like, I don't think that's gone away. I just think that instead of business cards, everybody has like a Wix or a Squarespace site that says they're the president of their company. And I think that it's okay to spend some time learning and developing a skill, whether that's school, if that works for you, whether that's at a job. Like I kind of wish that there was still more like master and apprentice relationships in work, where you could take the time to learn over the course of years and not necessarily over the course of reading like two Medium articles, to really understand the nuance of wisdom, where there's a lot of things, especially in business, where there's really no absolutes that you kind of just have to get a feel for to get better at them. And that takes time. And if you can learn that with somebody else's help or working somewhere else, like that is easier in some ways. I'm not saying everybody shouldn't just go out and be an entrepreneur, but I do think that there are easier ways to do it. And I think that a lot of time, and to speak to your point about passion, I think that a lot of times we're misguided in that idea, or we read too many quotes on Instagram where it's not enough to just like, we're talking about business here. Like if I'm passionate about playing ukulele, I need to go learn how to play ukulele, and that's awesome. And I think hobbies are great. But if we're talking about a business is serving others for money, and it needs to be valuable, and therefore it needs to be a skill that you've honed and worked on for a little bit of time. Like maybe not 10, 15 years, but maybe it's some amount of time that's more than a day or two. And I mean, we live in a society of instant gratification, so that's a bit of a downer of a message. But I think it's valid. I think it's valid. And I think there's really like two kinds of passion here. And I think that there's one that's just like a fickle flame, where it's like you find some new thing and you get super excited about it and you want it to consume your life, or it could be a person. And that's like, mm-hmm. But that kind of passion that burns super strong in the beginning can burn out. And I mean, most people have been in more than one relationship in their life and have seen that, or have had more than one hobby in their life and maybe have a garage full of like stand-up paddle boards and tennis rackets. But I think the other kind of, so I think applying that sort of passion to work is such a detriment, because I think that we want to work for a long period of time. And so I think that for a lot of things, I think passion, like real passion, like long burning passion, comes from mastery and experience. So like I wasn't passionate about being a writer until I worked at writing all the time. I didn't even want to be a writer, which pisses so many writers off, where like I didn't dream of being a writer when I was a kid. I think I dreamt of being a dinosaur. So since that wasn't available to me, except maybe at like an amusement park. Same with design. Like I was a designer for clients, at least for about 15, 16 years. That was never my passion. Like I didn't grow up wanting to do that. But as I did it, I started to learn I started to learn how much I enjoyed it and how much I enjoyed the day-to-day of it, where I could be in it and doing the thing all the time, every single day, and still enjoy it and still see like, oh my gosh, I'm just scratching the surface for what I know about this, or I'm just scratching the surface for how I can make this valuable enough for people to pay me. And I think that just like the idea of following our passion is difficult to swallow. And I also think it makes people feel bad about themselves, because a lot of people are like, well, I don't know what my passion is. And they beat themselves up about it. And it's like, it doesn't matter what your passion is. Like, just try a bunch of stuff. See what works. See what sticks. See what you want to get better at, what you want to learn more about. And then maybe that's going to get passionate for you eventually.
Well, it's interesting because you said the word relationship. And it's funny to me because even before I say this, I will preface with, I have a master's in counseling psychology, so I'm not completely full of crap. But it's it's interesting because it's actually good advice, even in a relationship. I mean, from the sense of the relationships that don't last are the ones that require full-time passion and romance because it's not a thing. I mean, those things don't last always. They aren't always turned on. But what you do in a relationship is you enjoy moments of passion and experiences of romance with each other, but you mostly invest time and yourself into that relationship. And what you will have is you won't have feelings of passion all the time. You won't have feelings of romance all the time, but you will have, you will experience it again, but in a different way or at a different level that you wouldn't early on in your relationship because you have something greater. You've built towards it. You have an experience together and you pursue, we might say, passions that say the two of you in a relationship might have by doing those things together, whatever. So I don't know. That might be a horrible tangent. Whoever's listening might be like, I have no idea what he just said, but.
No, dude, I think that's super valid.
Okay, good. Yes. Yes. Whew. Because as I got to the end, I wasn't sure if that made any sense. So there was another thing. There are a lot of things in your book that I found really interesting. I a lot of it resonated with me. And I think it will for a lot of other people too. But one of those things had to do from a creating perspective, like somebody who makes a product. And one of the things that that's sort of like an attribute of a company of one approach is that because your goal is not to become the biggest and the greatest and hire all the people and make all the money and do all the things, there's less pressure to do that, say with your product. So for example, instead, and this is one of the things you go into, and that you recommend, you just focus on the customer. You almost focus on them even on a one-on-one kind of relationship or perspective, if you can, you know, as much as you can scale that. And again, you talk about that too. And so the thing that I really liked about that was it made me think that if more people approach their business the way that you're, you know, ideologically talking about here, I think we're actually going to get better products. I think we're actually going to get better things. I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, like you said, it all depends. Like the type of business I want doesn't need to be huge to be successful or profitable. And I think it can reach kind of a state of enough where even with not even talking revenue, like if I'm just to talk about, say, the size of my mailing list, like obviously it needed to grow to a point where it would sustain my business because most of the money I make is through my list because I like doing email. But I have a size of a list where I can communicate, like I can send out an email to my list, which I do every Sunday, and I'll get a couple hundred replies, and I can interact with those people. Like I know the people's names that reply to me that buy the products. Like I can have a bit of a relationship with them, and I can learn from them, and I can kind of see like business is hard, and if I can make a few things about it easy, I'm gonna do that. And so if I can continue to have a dialogue, like a direct conversation with my audience, then I can see what they're working on, what they care about, what they're struggling with, what they need help with, what the patterns are in terms of like what they want from me. And then, yeah, like you said, I can make better products. If my list was 10 times or 100 times bigger than that, I would be getting more than 100, like I'd be getting thousands or tens of thousands of replies. I wouldn't be able to go through them all. I don't know how I would run my business that I like running in a way that would work with that sort of scale. So that kind of scale doesn't make sense to me. And it's not something that I go after. And I mean, in the book, like I think the chapter is called The One Customer, because I think once I reached a certain point in terms of like revenue and number of customers, I was like, okay, this is a good amount. Like I can offset churn and cover inflation and savings and stuff like that. But I can also, I can also manage this size of an audience, like really personally. Like, I don't have to act like a big business. I don't just send emails from like no reply at whatever domain name. I don't need to build these complex phone trees where it's like, your call is important to us. Please wait for the next operator in 36 to 38 minutes. Like, I can just run a business like a human being. Like, even my refund policy is just like, if you don't want me to have your money, I'll give it back. Like, right. I don't care when you ask for it. I don't care how much of the product you consumed or not consumed. I don't care if it's a year later.
It's like just less grief anyways. And then you get to avoid somebody, you know, completely setting you on fire online.
Yeah. And I just like, if I can run my business like a human being and treat my customers like human beings, then they're going to treat me like a human being and my business like a human being too, and be a little bit more forgiving, because like my business isn't perfect. And like, no business is perfect. But when I make mistakes, if I own them like a human being and say like, hey, look, this is, I up in the following ways. Here's how I'm going to fix it. And here's how it's not going to happen again. And most of the time people are like, yeah, okay, cool. Thanks for letting me know. As opposed to like releasing some crappy, like PR corporate-ese sounding press release. That's like, I don't even know what you're saying here. And you're not taking ownership for anything. And now I'm just even more mad.
I think you hit on a good point in general. I mean, I'm talking like just in life, just even in the state of politics and everything in the world right now, it seems like, which is, when we kind of distance or separate ourselves from those we have to interact with still, it's easy for us to, I mean, Twitter and internet is a perfect example of all this stuff, but it's very easy to, if you don't have that relationship, you can just jump all over that person. But yeah, but if I were to sit down with somebody I knew, a neighbor, a friend who had very different political views than I had, we would most likely, if they're a reasonable person, if they're as reasonable as I hope I am, we would have a pretty civil conversation for the most part. I'm not saying you're always going to have that. I mean, everybody, you know, has their own stuff, but for the most part, because I have had these conversations with my neighbors and where I live, we have more stuff in common than anything. If I were to take that over to my experience running a business and running Raven, a software company, I had very similar experiences like you described, where we would just refund them or what, you know, we would just deal with it like a human being and everything would be cool. Even if we screwed up or something went wrong or something didn't work.
Yeah.
If we had a relationship with them and we communicated with them, we did it in a reasonable amount of time and we treated them like a human being. And actually, it really comes down to the golden rule. If we treat them, if we treat others the way we want to be treated, it's amazing how well something that could go really wrong and go poorly ends up being a good breakup.
It's not even just some like hippie altruistic garbage either. Like it positively affects your bottom line as a business when you do that. And when you treat people like that, like you are going to make more money. You are going to have customers stick around for longer. You are going to have more people singing your praises publicly, which is hard to get people to do. And you can't even just ask for that. People just have to want to willingly do that. So I think all of those things, like, it's not just for like hippy dippy lifestyle businesses. Like it actually applies to like real profitable businesses.
Yeah, I don't think it's hippie at all. I mean, I think it's just how you know, treat people.
Yeah,
and exactly. And the word that comes to mind for me is loyalty, actually. I think that when you treat your customers that way, it creates a feeling of loyalty. And I think I'm trying to remember, because it was in chapter 7, the one customer chapter, you know, where you talk about how if you go about treating people that way, they're going to be more likely to forgive you than not. And I remember experiencing that particularly with Raven. I mean, we obviously, nobody's perfect. No software company's perfect. And we would make certain mistakes, but particularly the people I went out of my way to have a relationship or communicate with, when those things happen, they're like, I get it. I'm not happy about it, but I love you guys. Yeah. So I'm going to stay. So it really does actually go a long way.
Yeah. And it's cheaper to retain a customer than it is to go and find a new one. So I don't know why more people don't approach business with more of a mindset of retention than acquisition. Like, acquisition is just harder. Takes more time. It costs more money. It's more energy. It's more effort. Whereas just simply keeping the customers you have, if they're already paying you, they like something. If you can make them like you more because you're just treating them well or doing things that make sense as like a human to another human, then yeah, like you said, they're going to stick around. And like, that's also why there's a whole chapter on trust, because I think that that's kind of the most important thing. I think trust needs to be part, like, good marketing is trust. Like, good customer retention is trust. Good product development is trust. Like, all of it is just trust. It's like, if somebody trusts you enough to buy from you, then you're building a solid relationship there. Like, if they trust your brand, your authority, your solution for what you're selling, like, that's going to build a long-term or lifetime customer.
Another thing I liked about your book was, and I don't know if this is a testament to you or your editor, the way it was structured based on what you said earlier. I don't know who organized your thoughts, whether it was you or them, but as I read it, because I'm such a skeptic, I may come across as, to most of my friends and everybody, as jolly and easygoing, but I'm really skeptical. I mean, I'm super skeptical. And so as I would read it, I'd be like, but, and then it was, and then you would answer it. Or I'd be like, but, and you'd be like, oh, you did think about that, you know? And so I really, you know, enjoyed that. I mean, it's almost like insta respect, you know, as you're reading something, because you're like, oh yeah, this guy, he thought through all these things.
Well, and I'm skeptical too. That's just the way that I write. It's because I like, this isn't going to work. So like, if I think that way, then other people might think that way. So I better answer their concerns before they voice them kind of thing. And then that's what works for my writing.
Well, and it's to go back to the one customer, you know, concept, that was one of those instances I had where you started off with, you just need to go one-on-one with them, whatever. And I was like, that won't scale. and it's like, and then you, of course, go into be really smart about how you communicate with them, you know, with an ESP, you know, I mean, you know, look at segmentation, look at doing these things. And so it was really helpful. I mean, especially with what I'm doing now, that even applies with Koi, with what I'm doing now, I naturally already gravitate towards that style. I like to interact with everyone that I can with what I'm working on, because I'm both passionate and have experience with it. I know that at some point, I'm not going to be able to sustain that. So one of the things I really liked about that particular chapter, and when you talked about that, was it made me kind of think about that's, in fact, that's kind of a theme I had throughout this. I was just thinking about all these things that I need to do that I normally wouldn't think about, but it made me think about doing things now, even though I don't need them. So for example, in this particular case, it made me think that I should probably start segmenting, you know, even though I don't have a huge amount of customers or whatever, I should probably start defining and segmenting and stuff like that, so that I can continue to have meaningful communication and correspondence with them. And so I really appreciate the way you laid out things like that throughout the book. And I can only assume that everybody else who reads the book will kind of have the same experience. So
I would hope so. Yeah. And I mean, I think I think that we can still find ways to scale in the ways that we're talking about here, while still having like a human aspect to it. Like, even though somebody's reading my newsletter that I didn't write specifically for them, I'm a click away. Like, if they have a question, they can just hit reply. They don't have to like wait in a phone tree or like fill in a 50 thing form on a website. Like, it's still scale, even with like the sales funnels that I have. Like, I'm such an email nerd, and like I have such crazy sales funnels, but I'm still like first of all, my personality is still part of them. I don't know how to sell or write or market in a way that isn't just me talking about the things I'm interested in. And so it's still me, but it's like, even my welcome email, I think it talks about like me getting your name tattooed on my arm or something like that. It makes sense. I'm covering tattoos.
Is there any more room? Aren't you like super tattooed?
Yes, I am. But okay. I mean, like that fits my brand and it's still like an automated message, but people get a sense of me instantly. Like, and some people are going to be like, no, pass, like hard pass on this. And I've had people like, I don't like tattoos. I don't want to be on your list. I'm like, cool. I'm glad we got this out of the way now. Instead of later, or instead of like after you bought something, then you find something about my personality you don't like, and then you want a refund. And that's just annoying to have to deal with. So I'd rather people find out like who I am right away and like and use that and kind of lean on that and still be like super accessible, but it's still like scaled, it's still automated in some ways. Cause I do want to take stuff off my plate, but I also want to still retain that. Like human aspect of it. And I think we can have both.
Well, and if you're taking the approach, you know, that you describe in your book, then it may be that those concerns about an inability to scale in that fashion, the inability to be able to reply in a reasonable manner and that type of thing takes care of itself in the fact that you're pulling back a little bit, that part of this approach is to always be, you know, looking at everything, kind of where everything is, and then asking yourself, is this enough? Should I stay kind of where I am and actually focus on just making what I have better? Yeah. And, you know, am I making enough? You know, do I really need more? And do I prefer to be able to maintain open lines of communication with my customers, like you just described, or am I willing to be like, this isn't enough for me. And I understand that I'm going to lose that. I may lose that aspect if I go any further. And of course, I think from your perspective, you're pushing for don't like pause, like consider pausing and being happy with what you have.
Yeah. And at least make it a quest. Cause I think too often, it's just the next logical step, or at least if we're talking about business, it's like, if we're successful, we should grow. Like if this is working, then let's double up on that. And it's like, that's fine sometimes. Like that totally works. And I would never say growth is bad, but I just think, like you said, like there just needs to be a pause first, like consider it, consider whether or not it makes sense for like things like how it will affect like the responsibilities in your life or how you want to spend your day, how it will affect your happiness, how it might affect your profit. Because more revenue rarely means more profit, like just as a blanket statement. Maybe more means not serving or helping your existing customers as much, which could be a non-starter for you. Maybe more just means it's serving your ego or your social standings more than something you actually want in life. So I think, yeah, like you said, like considering enough is probably one of the most important things we can do with our work. It's like, how much is enough? How will I know when I've reached it? And what will change when I do reach it?
I think for a lot of people, perhaps most people, that's actually a profound statement. I think that I'm serious. I mean, I think that it is not how you do it. And that's again why I really like this concept in this book is and it's not hippie. I don't think it's hippie. You know, I think it is.
I've just been accused of that, which is why.
No, I get it. I get it. And maybe you are hippie, but I'm saying that this is not hippie me. This is about quality of life. That's what it's about to me. And it's funny because a lot of these things are very consistent with how you said you are and your personality and how you changed it like 19 or whatever, which is, wait a second. I don't have to be this way. This is not how it has to be. I don't have to live my life the way everybody has been told they have to, and they are. I can choose sort of my own destiny and even degree of happiness versus just doing what you're supposed to be doing. And I think that's throughout this. And I think it could potentially, I don't know, maybe I'm sounding too ethereal or whatever, but I mean, I think this could be sort of like a really good awakening for a lot of people who are just doing what everybody has told them up to this point, and they're not happy and they want more and they wish they could be doing more, but they don't know that there's options. You know, a lot of this is about being mindful. I mean, so.
Yeah. And I mean, I hope that that's the case. I hope it is an awakening for some people, because I think that, like, we're kind of shown that success looks like this one thing. And I don't think that it does. Like, I don't think that it does. And I think the problem with chasing success that somebody else has defined, so one of two things will happen. Neither are good. I think we chase somebody else's version of success and we achieve it, we better hope that we are happy and content with their version, because it may not be ours. And if it's not ours, then we've just wasted our time chasing somebody else's version. If we don't win at achieving that version of success that we've seen on TV or on the internet or on social media or in other business books, then we'll probably beat ourselves up because we feel like we failed. But we failed. But wait a minute, we failed at something we didn't actually want. So why are we beating ourselves up for? So it's like a lose-lose. So either way. So I think that, like you said, I think that this little bit of introspection, which is definitely difficult to do, I'm not saying otherwise, I think is required. Like, what is success to you? And it's different for you, John. It's different for people listening. Mm-hmm. It's different for me. It's different for everybody. But it's worth considering. And I think that, like, we're so adverse in society to introspection and to self-reflection that it's really damaging. I think there's this funny, pretty sure I wrote about it in the book. There's a study done. I think the guy's name is Timothy Wilson. I can't remember which school, where they put participants of the study in a room. They didn't say what the study was for. They said something that wasn't true. And they're like, just sit in the room. You have nothing to do. There's a button on the table. If you press it, you'll get an electric shock. It's not going to kill you, but it's going to hurt. And they're like, all you have to do is sit here. You don't have to press the button. The button pressing is 100% optional. You can just sit there in silence if you want. Most people press the button because most people were too, just didn't want to sit with their thoughts. They didn't have their phones. They didn't have social media to like pull and refresh. And so they just wanted something to do, because something to do is easier than just being introspective. I mean, that comes back to the very beginning of the conversation that we had. Like, moving to the woods was the biggest mind for, like, honestly, it was so radically hard to deal with, because like I went from living like the place that we lived in a glass condo. And we were across the road from an animated advertisement billboard. And we had like blackout curtains. We lived right beside a stadium where the Vancouver Canucks played. So every time they lost, which they did pretty much every game, we'd have to listen to people. So we had like a fan that basically was a white noise machine. Like, there's so much stimulus, and there's just so much stimulus in our lives constantly. And we're all connected or tethered to these tiny pocket computers that, like, it's scary to be alone with our thoughts. Like, it is 100% hard and scary and difficult sometimes. But I also think it's the most important work that we can do in our lives or in our businesses.
Do you think that being able to figure out how to do that, because I think a lot of people don't know how to do that, is a requirement to sort of accomplishing the things that you've laid out?
Yeah, I would. So I think it's difficult, but I think it's doable. And I mean, I don't think we all start with like being able to sit and meditate for an hour. I think that that would be ridiculous. But I think maybe it's sitting, like, see if you can sit for 30 seconds and just not look at your computer or your phone or any notifications. Like, maybe it starts with that. And I mean, a lot of people that I know meditate, and I mean, I definitely do as well, but like, I don't think meditation is a requirement. I just think being able to like reflect. I mean, even going for a walk without music or your phone is a meditation. Like, being at the gym without looking, like everybody's on their phone everywhere. Like, mm-hmm. Be somewhere and don't do anything for even just a tiny amount of time. See what happens. See that you have not died. Right. Build on build on that skill, I think, is like, you don't have to move to the woods on an island in the middle of nowhere to achieve this. Like, I'm not the smartest person, so I had to do that. But most people are probably much smarter than that and will be able to do it to whatever degree works for them in a much easier, much, much easier way.
Well, and as you find ways or force yourself into, I'll just call it moments of silence in a sense, you know, getting rid of the noise in your life. And like you were saying, you people don't even know what to do with themselves in that. That's actually the work. Like, that's the work. In other words, when you're in there and you know what to do and you feel weird and you're wondering, I wonder what people are thinking about me because I'm just sitting here by myself, not on my phone, because that's the beginning of the work. That's what you're, that is the point. That is what you should think about. And then gradually over time, you will start to be comfortable with just yourself and being alone in your thoughts, and then can hopefully be in a place where you can consider all of the things that I think you've kind of presented in this book and how you can be successful, we'll say, even though that's a loaded word, but also be content and happy and I'll leave it with purposeful.
Yeah. And I mean, I like to tell people, like, there's no, like, if you get the book looking for answers, there aren't any. It's the worst sales pitch ever. But I think it's important because, like, there are no answers. Like, I think Seth Godin even wrote on his blog like a few days ago, or it doesn't even matter because I know what this is, just being recorded and put out when it's put out. But like 90% of coaching is self-coaching. Like, the point of the book is to give you a framework to make better decisions for your life and for your business. And I can't give you what those decisions are. I can only help you develop tools to be able to make decisions so that you're ultimately happy with the decisions that you make. Because you need to be able to think about things. You need to be able to have introspection to decide what is right for you. Because I can't tell you that. Nobody can tell you that. Anybody that says they can tell you that is going to sell you something next that is going to solve your problems, or that they say is going to solve your problems that is not going to solve your problems.
Hey, thanks for meeting with me. This is great. I've absolutely loved this conversation, and I really enjoy reading your book, and I can't recommend it highly enough.
Thank you. I appreciate it. This is a lot of fun. So thank you very much.